Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're going to talk in a wide-ranging conversation with one of our favorite contributors here about, well, enemies, foreign and domestic, and the threat that we currently face from them, and to the extent we can, what we can and must do to counter them. His name is Charles Sam Faddis. He is very much a featured guest here. We're very proud of that. He is also a man who has served his country in a number of different important capacities as an Army officer in JAG specialization for part of his career there, as an undercover operative at the Central Intelligence Agency in a lot of unsavory places, advancing American interests, including as one of the initial elements on the ground in places like Afghanistan and Iraq. He has also been a very important figure in his post-government service as the proprietor these days of And Magazine at Substack.com. I strongly commend it to you as a resource. Sam Faddis, welcome back to Securing America. It's great to have you with us, sir.
It is great, as always, to be here, Frank. Thank you, sir.
Let me begin with a story that broke yesterday, and I'm very keen to get your take on it, Sam. It is the President of the United States, at least the people doing business as Joe Biden, have called up a relatively small number of reserves, but nonetheless have begun tapping into a body of men and women who have, by and large, served their country in various other roles and are now in the Independent Ready Reserve, for example. Mm-hmm. Why do you think he's doing that, or they are doing it?
Yeah, it's very, very, very troubling, right, on so many different levels. I mean, first of all, he's calling up these individual ready reservists, so people who aren't affiliated, like drilling with units, they're basically carried on a roster, right? I was carried in that capacity for quite some time after I left the U.S. Army. He's calling up these people to send them to fill slots. This is all connected to Ukraine. And it's just more evidence of, okay, you're just driving down this road to continuous escalation and provocation and so forth. Again, as I say all the time, no friend of Vladimir Putin's and no supporter of the Russian objectives in Ukraine, but where is the strategy and where is the plan and where is the end to this thing? And we just keep piling on here. So that suggests, at a minimum, complete blindness to the danger. But, you know, these days that doesn't really seem adequate, does it? I mean, we're apparently bound and determined to turn this into a broader, more destructive conflict and to get sucked into this thing directly. I would also add that meanwhile, right, for the last 3 or 4 days now, the Chinese have been conducting massive incursions into Taiwanese airspace, ringed the island with ships. One day, I think a couple of days ago, they had 68 separate aircraft entering the air defense zone of Taiwan. So you've got the number one enemy ramping up continuously to, at a minimum, blockade Taiwan. Meanwhile, we're drawing down our weapon stocks and focusing all our attention on the Ukraine war and all of that against the backdrop of where the money has come from the Biden smells pretty bad, doesn't it?
Drawing down our weapon stocks has become a particularly, I think, evident problem in the form of even Joe Biden himself pronouncing that we've run out, I guess it's more accurate to say, of 155 artillery shells to send to Ukraine, to the point where we don't have enough for our own defensive purposes. Hence, we need to send them cluster bombs, which is another story, which is evidence of that kind of ratcheting up to what end. But, you know, I did a commentary this morning where speculating about why would Joe Biden be doing this? One piece of it is Ukraine, as you say. I wonder whether, and chuck this up to cynicism, but I don't think cynicism is misplaced with this outfit. But, you know, are they trying to cover for the fact, or compensate to some extent, for the fact that they have destroyed the recruitment efforts that are necessary to maintain our all-volunteer force by beginning to bring back people who have previously served? And I said independent, I meant individual ready reservists among them. The principal reason for that destruction of recruitment in the ranks, as you know so well, Sam, is that people don't want to serve in a woke Biden military. Many, including people who are currently serving, who are bugging out because they don't want to be part of it, let alone have their children and others encouraged to come in. And then finally, not least, I wonder whether one of the things is also in play here as they intensify the threat of war and the danger of it with Ukraine specifically, trying to get people like C.Q. Brown, the general who's been nominated to become the next chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and a whole host of others of lesser rank who are being promoted by this Biden team, blown through the United States Senate, where they're currently on hold, thanks to Senator Tommy Tuberville of Alabama. Could all of those be factors as well in this, do you think?
Absolutely, and they have certainly destroyed recruiting. If they're not recruiting shortfalls, we're not falling a percentage short or something, which has happened in the past. There are massive recruiting shortfalls. They're not anywhere close to bringing in the number of folks. And Brown's confirmation hearing, I mean, to me is, I mean, look, everything I've heard about the guy, he's a competent pilot. I'm not suggesting that he got his rank by virtue of the fact that he's African-American. But when you listen to the man, you know, whether this was always him or whether this is the ideology that he's absorbed, that he's an ideologue, and his ideology is abhorrent to me as a former military officer and coming from a military family. I mean, I've listened to videos where this guy's talking to airmen, and all he's talking about is how many, what percentage of you are black, and what percentage of you are female. And to anybody who's ever been in the military, you know, it's colorblind, man. You're only one color. And you fight for America, and you never think in those terms. It's one team, one fight, and you live it and you die it. And the idea that this guy's tribalizing the military. I also listened to the part where one of the senators asked him about an 18-year-old woman going through basic training, being forced to shower with men because those men had identified, whatever that means, as women. And you would expect this general to react with rage, like, I haven't heard about this, but I'm going to find out who's responsible, and I will guarantee you that's never happening again. Instead, he gives this mamby-pamby, I promise you I'll be sensitive to people being uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable, right. Yeah. Yeah. It was Senator Mike Rounds, who I was very pleased to see put the question to him. And it wasn't just that they're showering with him. She was also saying she's really concerned because she's sleeping in open barracks, basically.
Absolutely.
With these men as well. And, yes. You know, we had Elaine Donnelly on the other day, and Elaine has done great work on this for many, many years. Many of those years in which the focus was the problems of rape in the military.
Absolutely.
Men on female, female on female, I guess, men on men. And this just seems as though it's throwing all of that out the window in the interest of, as you say, a radical transgender ideology. And it's deeply distressing. And I can only imagine how you feel as a veteran of the armed forces. Sam, we have to take a short break. We'll be right back with more on the other side of this. Stay tuned. Specifically, I want to talk with you about General Brown and this larger agenda as well. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The House of Representatives voted last week to correct some of the most egregious examples of the Marxist makeover currently afflicting our military men and women. The Senate will shortly consider its version of the National Defense Authorization Act. Tragically, Democrats in the majority there are expected to endorse racist, merit-crushing diversity priorities, transgender accommodations that imperil servicewomen's privacy and safety, and illegal government funding of abortion-related expenses. Fortunately, the Senate can demonstrate that it, too, wants the restoration of America's military greatness, not its further ravaging, by rejecting an exemplar of so-called woke in uniform, General C.Q. Brown, President Biden's nominee to become the next Joint Chiefs Chairman. At rejectgeneralbrown.org, you can tell your senators to start returning our armed forces to their historic values, traditions, and practices that are essential to deterring conflict and, if that fails, to prevailing in battle. This is Frank Affney.
We're back, and we are continuing our conversation. We have each week, I'm privileged to say, with Charles Sam Faddis, United States Army veteran, as well as a veteran of the Central Intelligence Agency. And Sam, we were talking about this General C.Q. Brown, and I think the point you were getting at is the military in which you served was one mission, one fight, colorblind meritocracy. What C.Q. Brown stands for and is championing, it's not just a case, it seems, of going along to get along or going along to get the gig of the new chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He seems to be all in and has been for some time. Is already wreaking havoc in places like the Air Force Academy. His current job, he's the chief of staff of the Air Force, and that academy is a new treasure trove of documents that Judicial Watch, our friends over there, were able to extract from the Freedom of Information Act process, have documented is, you know, an insane asylum of this kind of it's called woke, but it's Marxism, really. I think it's true of the other academies to varying degrees as well, but it's particularly apparently a problem there. And that is in part because the guy who ultimately is responsible for the operation is all in on this agenda. So I just wonder, and I know you know people who are still serving, you've got family and so on, but has the military been mutated, been beyond recognition, and more to the point, beyond recovery, do you think?
Well, I don't know if it has yet been mutated to the point where it's beyond recovery, but I would say that I am absolutely convinced that people need to understand this is not just weakness. This is not just going along to get along. I mean, that may be the case with specific individuals. This is an express agenda. The stuff that's being taught at the academies is overtly Marxist. I mean, it is, if you lifted it out of the pages of Marx and Engels, the whole business about history is of struggle of the oppressed against oppressors and all of this. This is Marxism.
And now, the classic Marxist, of course, used class, I think, more than sure. race, but they've adapted their
slightly different
ideology.
Slightly different verbiage, absolutely, yeah. But this is expressly Marxist. And I would submit to you, and I don't think this is an analogy that goes too far. When the Bolsheviks were taking power in Russia, between the time that the Tsar fell and then they ultimately staged what amounts to a coup, what was their first and primary focus, or at least one of their focus, was we must transform the military. We cannot have, in that case, primarily an army that opposes us. We must ideologically take control of that institution. And they focus tremendous energy on that. You read accounts of how all of a sudden individual soldiers would be wearing red ribbons on their uniforms to signify, you know, to use today's terminology, that they were woke and their heads were in the right place. Okay, well, that's what's happening here. This is not one-off. This is a sustained effort. I mean, we've got, you know, we basically got Mr. Bishop of Commissar now for the DOD. We've got cadets being and midshipmen being told white people are inherently racist and bad, and expressly that it is not only okay, but required to discriminate against them because they are by their nature oppressors, and therefore we have to even the scales. I mean, this is really radical stuff that is now not some guy who's off the rails somewhere in DOD. No, this is coming from the top. This is what you're required to do. Fitness reports in the military, performance evaluations, no longer use the words he and she, right? It's now this gender neutral they, them stuff. That's not okay. That's mandated.
Yeah. And even more outrageous idea with which General Brown is associated is that the use of the terms mother and father at the Air Force Academy was impermissible because that would offend certain people. I look, bottom line, at a time when I think we agree, Sam, there is a distinct prospect, if not a virtual certitude, that our mortal enemy, the Chinese Communist Party, is perceiving all of this as a window of opportunity in which to advance their agenda of not just global governance, but of destroying this country. To have in charge of the only military we have people who are preoccupied with this kind of agenda and are morphing, perhaps as you say, maybe not irreversibly yet, but certainly to a point that is perilous, yes, in time of war. It is completely unacceptable. And I personally believe, and I invite your comment on this, that the United States Senate, if it confirms General C.Q. Brown, would be validating the direction in which he and, of course, Biden are trying to take this country's military. And it will be on the heads of any senator who does vote for his confirmation as the next chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. For the whirlwind that will be reaped if and when the Chinese Communist Party acts on this perceived window of opportunity. Your thoughts, sir?
I agree with you 100%. There is no way on earth the Senate should confirm this guy. Again, he's apparently a competent officer as a pilot and so forth. However he got there, the mindset, the ideology he's expressing is intolerable. This is the ultimate meritocracy in American society, right? Where it doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is your performance. And that's how you rise to the, and we are waging war on that.
But could I just once again say, it is, perhaps, it certainly has been, but more to the point, it must be a meritocracy,
yes,
for it to do the job we need it to do. Absolutely. Sam, if the Chinese Communist Party threat were not bad enough, and as you know, as a distinguished member of our Committee on the Present Danger of China, it is, and we've written a book with your help on the subject, and titled The Indictment. We also have this other problem that is getting almost no attention at all. I'm incredulous when I say that, apart from what you've been doing at andmagazine.com at Substack, which I strongly commend again to all of our listeners. And that is the fact that we have turned Afghanistan under Joe Biden and under people like, if not actually C.Q. Brown, certainly people like him, his predecessor, Mark Milley, over to the Taliban.
Yep.
And you warned at the time and subsequently that that is a disaster. Talk to us a little bit about just how much of a disaster it is in terms of not only the kit that we left with them, the country that they now control, right, but also what they're doing with it.
Well, I mean, let's just grab a hold of a piece, right? Al-Qaeda now has a safe haven. Saif al-Adel, who is functionally their leader, is ensconced there. There are Al-Qaeda
officials. They're back, as they say, right?
Al-Qaeda officials literally incorporated directly into the Taliban government. There are governors of provinces in Afghanistan under the Taliban who are Al-Qaeda officials. There are training camps. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of Al-Qaeda operatives. They are training the Pakistani Taliban. Keep in mind, Al-Qaeda also has a worldwide presence. They are not confined to Afghanistan. They're particularly a growth industry in Africa. We are back.
As is the Islamic State, right?
Yeah, this is just a group that has safe haven there. We're back to the years in the run-up to 9/11, where we're giving these guys the time and space and breathing room they need.
Only this time, we've also given them $83 billion worth of advanced weaponry, which might just turn up to be handy. Maybe it's overthrowing the government of Pakistan, as you say. Sam, I want you to hold this thought. We'll be right back with more on Al-Qaeda gunning for us from a safe haven in Afghanistan. Sound familiar? Stay tuned for more right after this.
Destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. Sam Faddis is in the house virtually, as we have the privilege of saying about this time each week. We're always grateful to him for his participation in this program, as well as for all he does. What he's done in uniform, what he's done undercover for the CIA, what he's been doing in the public policy arena, notably in my home state of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania to try to assure election integrity and so much more. Sam, among other things, what you do is report on so many different topics for us at andmagazine.com at Substack. You have had a very important piece about Al-Qaeda being back in business in Taliban-controlled Afghanistan. Just talk a little bit about this unbelievable windfall that the jihadis, global jihadis, by the way, picked up in terms of all of these military assets left behind, deliberately left behind by Joe Biden, and what that means in terms of not only threats to our interests and personnel elsewhere around the world, but perhaps also to us.
Well, I think the best estimates are something like north of $80 billion worth of stuff that was dumped there, left behind there, whatever verbiage you want to use, including a lot of very sophisticated stuff. And like a lot of things with the Biden administration, people sort of, you hear about this, and then of course the media does their best to bury it. So it's left as, okay, maybe that should be a problem and it could be a problem in the future. Well, it's a problem right now. I mean, the weapons that we left behind are in the hands of the Pakistani Taliban. You read all the time that the Pakistani military is talking about their security forces that are in gunfights with the Pakistani Taliban, whose express purpose is to overthrow the government of Islamabad. And they're being outgunned because the Pakistani the Taliban now has night vision devices and weapons that are superior to what the Pakistanis have. A lot of this stuff went into Iranian hands. That's also widely reported. The Iranians have gotten a hold of this. They showed up almost immediately as fast as Kabul fell. So, I mean, the implications are enormous here. And one thing that I think people need to understand is, you know, look, however the withdrawal in Kabul went down and Afghanistan went down, obviously it was horribly done. And those huge parks of MRAP vehicles, mine-resistant vehicles, and all these other things that are sitting in bases could have been destroyed. Even if we were somehow, you're going to say, okay, we were caught off guard, which for which there's no excuse. We retained the capacity to fire Tomahawk missiles or drop munitions on these things and take out the bulk of this equipment after we left. After all, it was all sitting places that where we put it. It wasn't hard to find, and you can't hide 500 vehicles parked in a parking lot. So every day after the fall of Kabul, but we chose not to do that, as you put it, you're exactly right. We were affirmatively making the decision to give all this stuff to these guys. We could have destroyed it before we left. We could have destroyed it any day after we left. In many cases, to this day, we could still destroy much of it. And yet we choose to give it to the Taliban.
Yeah. And more to the point, we are portraying the Taliban as partners. As I understand it, we're not taking too much exception to this Al-Qaeda or ISIS or other kinds of collaboration, let alone integrating into their governance structure. It's just staggering, isn't it?
When Biden said in the recent past that I was right, the Taliban is helping us against Al-Qaeda, I thought there was nothing you could say that would shock me or boggle me. But good Lord, man, even for you to say that, a bunch of guys who are themselves terrorists and many of whom are on our terrorist watch list with rewards of $5 million on their head, those guys are your partners. Not to mention it's factually untrue, but like you're bragging about that. You're in business with the Haqqanis now. Is that what's going on?
Well, sadly, I think it's of a piece with how the Biden administration is conceiving other enemies of our country as partners and friends and just competitors and the like. But speaking of terrorism and watch lists, let me turn quickly with you to the border. Sam, you've been trying to track what's coming across it. It is open, the southern border of the United States. That's no secret. It's certainly known to every bad actor on the planet, as well as a lot of other people who are just simply trying to improve the quality of their lives by coming here and tapping in, among other things, to our social safety net and opportunities. But the people who are coming across, and I understand it's kind of a record number at the moment of people who are actually known to be terrorists,
yes,
characterized as such on watch lists, is obviously just a fraction of the people who are making their way over, who are not known or are not caught or not counted for sure. Just give us a quick course on how, as a very seasoned, accomplished threat assessor in the national security arena, you perceive what is now migrating north and also, for that matter, inside the country and being distributed all across it. At taxpayer expense.
Well, I mean, anything and everything. Just indulge your nightmare scenarios of what could happen. There is no impediment. There is no barrier. We don't have a border anymore. One of the things that strikes me, just to grab a hold of a piece of this, is we keep seeing X number of people who are on the terrorist watch list are apprehended. Okay. And again, that's a fraction of the people, presumably. No follow-up as to why. What does that mean? Is the supposition that all these terrorists just randomly, accidentally wandered across the border? We apprehended them?
Or just want a better life in that country.
Or they all of a sudden don't want to be suicide bombers anymore. Now they want a better life. And like, what's the purpose? There was a Yemeni guy, as an example, a couple of Yemenis that came across the border. This is 18 months ago, probably. They were both caught separately coming across, but they were obviously together. One of these guys has a SIM card hidden in one of his shoes. Well, that kind of jumps out as maybe not the most sophisticated tradecraft, but clearly tradecraft. This is guy coming for a purpose. End of story. Cone of silence descends. No follow-up. No, hey, that smells like those are operatives coming in the country to stage an attack. Maybe we ought to run that down. Nothing. Just buried. So I don't have any confidence at all that anybody is investigating any of that. Where's the rest of the team? What teams did we miss? What's about to happen?
And Sam, you've also reported at N Magazine at Substack about a whole nother level of problem, which is Chinese nationals who all curiously seem to be military-aged, unaccompanied, fit men are coming across the border in sizable numbers. And I can't share the sources in either of these cases, but in one instance, it was a very senior congressional figure who clearly was in a position to know, who estimated that the number of these people he characterized as likely People's Liberation Army operatives, as have you in your previous reporting, maybe as many as 10,000 inside the United States now, just as a result of this migration in recent months. I said that to a fellow who is in another line of work, but also in a position to know intimately. And he said, our number is many times larger than that. What do you make of this particular threat and the prospects that something very bad is in store for us here on the home front as a result?
Well, I mean, if the worst case scenario is true here, and there's a lot of reason to think that it is, what do you think thousands and thousands and thousands of military-aged Chinese males are being sent here to do in the United States? Obviously, something.
Not for a better life.
Not for a better life, not to hang out, not to go to McDonald's. So, again, it seems to me we're back to where we are in so many of these things. Okay, so grab a hold of that and run it to ground and seriously investigate it. That's not hard. You've got these guys in custody. You can find out where they come from, what's their background, how are they doing it.
We have them in custody, Sam? That's news to me.
Well, okay.
I thought they were just being turned loose.
You're right. My verb tenses are bad. We had them in custody at some point and could have grabbed a hold of them and said, okay, you're not going anywhere until we get to the bottom of what the hell is happening here. As you guys all come out of the jungle in good order, like a military unit moving into the United States.
Similar backpacks and canteens.
Similar backpacks and canteens. And as Michael Yan says, looking, makes him feel like he's back at Fort Bragg looking at a special forces team, right? We ought to grab a hold of these guys, and you're not going anyplace until we run this down. And we're not doing, as with everything else, we just let it go.
Literally, in this case, let it go. And as I said earlier, Sam, move them around the country.
Yes.
Now, I mean, again, if we survive all of this and there is some sort of historical retrospective, people will be absolutely incredulous at what you've just described, all of what you've just described, really. Yeah. And yet we're living it, folks, that we're making history as we speak. And it's a history that is so fraught with peril that we don't share this with you to terrify you. We share this with you in the prayerful hope that you will help us turn this around, that you will help take actions, especially with your elected representatives, to insist that different policies be adopted immediately. Sam, we have to let you go. Thank you for a superb visit, as always. God bless you in the work you do these days at nmagazine.com. I hope people check it out and follow him at Substack as I do. We'll be right back with more on the other side of this very short break. I urge you to stay tuned for Trevor Louden.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The House of Representatives voted last week to correct some of the most egregious examples of the Marxist makeover currently afflicting our military men and women. The Senate will shortly consider its version of the National Defense Authorization Act. Tragically, Democrats in the majority there are expected to endorse racist, merit-crushing diversity priorities, transgender accommodations that imperil servicewomen's privacy and safety, and illegal government funding of abortion-related expenses. Fortunately, the Senate can demonstrate that it, too, wants the restoration of America's military greatness, not its further ravaging, by rejecting an exemplar of so-called woke in uniform, General C.Q. Brown, President Biden's nominee to become the next Joint Chiefs Chairman. At rejectgeneralbrown.org, you can tell your senators to start returning our armed forces to their historic values, traditions, and practices that are essential to deterring conflict and, if that fails, to prevailing in battle. This is Frank Affney.
We're back, and I'm pleased to say we are joined by one of our great friends from overseas. His name is Ambassador Yoram Edinger. He is a very faithful contributor to this program, for which we are deeply grateful. He has long experience in the foreign service of his country, that would be the State of Israel, including quite an extended service here in the United States as a congressional representative for Israel to the United States Congress with the rank of ambassador. Mr. Ambassador, thank you for joining us as always. Thank you also for the Edinger Report, which is a really important resource, I think, for all of us who are interested in not just what's going on in Israel, but why it matters to us here in the United States as well. And I caught your, I think, one of your most recent reports entitled Defiance of U.S. Pressure Enhances U.S.-Israel Cooperation. That's a very interesting proposition, especially insofar as much of the analysis talks about a lack of U.S.-Israel cooperation arising from the seeming profound enmity of the Biden administration towards Israel. We had a long conversation with Carolyn Glick about this the other day, but give us your thoughts on the background to your most recent analysis.
Well, my assumption is that American policymakers, and especially American national security, intelligence, defense industry, congressional leaders, are very realistic. And on a rainy day, they are not looking for an ally which is a pushover, an ally which does not stand up to pressure, vacillating and appeasing, and retreats from any political or military challenge. Americans basically do not have to agree with you, but they have to respect you. And in that case, a series of Israeli prime ministers who were subjected to pressure by the White House and especially by the State Department and defied that pressure, it was resulted in a short-term friction, short-term tension, but due to their defiance of American pressure, it yielded long-term strategic respect because they proved themselves as principle-driven allies of the U.S. And in fact, when you go back and you examine each one of those occasions when the U.S. pressured Israel and Israel defied that pressure, you find out that indeed the defiance of pressure served very, very well America's own interest, in addition to Israeli interest.
One of my favorite examples of this story is a story about Golda Meir
speaking with President Nixon, who was pressuring her, as you say, to make territorial concessions to the Arabs at the time. And, you know, she basically said to him, when he promised her security guarantees in exchange for those concessions, which would have made Israel essentially indefensible, "Mr. President, the problem with your security guarantees is by the time you get here, we won't be here." And having stood up to him, I think he did respect her more. And as you say, that stance served Israel and the United States very well. I'm asking this question in the context of a different kind of presidency, though, I'm afraid. In the past, I think, with some possible exceptions, you had people who basically were supportive of the state of Israel, basically wanted it to survive, basically saw it as a valuable ally. I'm not entirely sure that's the case with the Biden team. Your perspective on that, sir?
But if, even if we go back and we examine pressure during very friendly presidents, an example is President Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan opposed, and I would add brutally, well, it was mostly his cabinet, but he opposed brutally the Israeli plan to bomb Iraq's nuclear reactor. Israel defied the pressure. Israel, in fact, was punished. And supply of combat aircraft was suspended for a while. Joint defense accords between the two defense industries were suspended. But 10 years later, when U.S. and Iraq were engaged in the first Gulf War, then the U.S. realized that the Israeli defiance of U.S. pressure in 1981 spared the U.S. a potential nuclear confrontation in 1991. The same thing was back in 1967. Very friendly President LBJ, who warned Israel from preempting the planned attack on Israel by Egypt, Syria, and Jordan. The message from LBJ to then Prime Minister Eshkol was, if you shall act alone, you shall remain alone. Israel preempted in 1967 and obliterated the military power of Egypt, which threatened at that time every single pro-American oil-producing Arab regime, thus sparing the free world, the U.S. in particular, an economic disaster, and basically blocked the Soviet Union from a major bonanza at the expense of the USA. The current administration does impose an intensified pressure on Israel. The aim is to prevent an independent Israeli military action against Iran's nuclear infrastructure and to force Israel into a retreat from the mountains of Judea and Samaria, the West Bank. Israel defies that pressure. And if you examine the pressure, should Israel accede, it would undermine severely America's interest.
We will have to take a short break, Mr. Ambassador. We'll come back on exactly that point in just a moment and talk a bit more about what the U.S. government is now proposing to do with, kind of blacklisting Bibi Netanyahu and having the Israeli president come instead to the United States. We'll be right back with Ambassador Ettinger right after this. We're back. We are continuing our conversation with one of the most distinguished diplomats I know. His name is Ambassador Yoram Ettinger of Israel. great friend, as well as a very important contributor to Securing America. We're always delighted to have him with us. Mr. Ambassador, you just made the point, I think, very strongly that misguided efforts by the United States to compel Israel to make steps that are neither in its interest nor really ours, when rebuffed by the Israelis, has actually been a boon to America, as well as, of course, necessary to Israel's security. At the moment, as you were just saying, the government of the United States thinks that Israel must do nothing about the now incipient nuclear capability of Iran, and must allow a second state to emerge from the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and who knows, maybe the Golan Heights. I don't know what the hell they have in mind. But what we do know is they've been represented in much of this by people like Rob Malley, who have been viscerally and vehemently hostile to the government of Israel. He seems to be in a bit of trouble at the moment. He's lost his security clearances, is off the beat, I guess, with respect to brokering deals with the Iranians, praise God. But the question to you, sir, is at this very moment, one of the things that the U.S. government is doing under the Biden administration to pressure Israel is essentially to blacklist the leader of your government, the elected prime minister of the state of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu. They are now allowing the sort of head of state, the largely ceremonial figure, it's Isaac Boogie Herzog, to come to speak to a joint session of Congress, as I understand it. We've been hearing from Carolyn and I think yourself and others certainly about this fellow being a little bit less than a reliable representative of the Netanyahu government, shall we say, with some partisan background between them. But what's that about? And does this put into slight of different sort of character the kind of pressure that the United States is bringing to bear from what you've seen in the past, sir?
Well, the way I look at it is that after 4 years of being sidelined away from the center of foreign policy making, the State Department is back at center stage, complement of President Biden and led by Secretary of State Blinken, who represents most authentically the cosmopolitan worldview of the State Department, namely preferring to work together with the anti-US United Nations and international organizations than with Israel and Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and Egypt, and also a cosmopolitan worldview which deludes itself that the Palestinian issue is a central piece in Arab policy making. The suspension of Netanyahu's invitation to Washington serves as a means of exerting pressure on Israel to change its stance, both on the military option against Iran, as well as on the issue of a Palestinian state. The challenge, in my mind, of President Herzog when he arrives to the White House, but especially at the joint session of on Capitol Hill, will be to shed light on the fact that the current policy of diplomatic option upheld by the administration towards Iran is self-defeating, undermining America's interests, undermining the interest of every single pro-American Arab regime in the Middle East, playing into the hands of the Ayatollahs of Iran, who are collaborating with America's enemies in Central America and in South America. The challenge by Herzog will be to present to the U.S. the need, the logical need, to hold an effective military club above the head of the rogue Ayatollah's regime in Tehran, if at all there is any hope for a diplomatic option. In my mind, there is no such hope, because the Ayatollahs have proven themselves to be a non-good faith negotiator. They have proven themselves to be ardent enemies of the U.S. And likewise with the Palestinian issue, it sounds like a very logical and moral proposition to establish a Palestinian state, until you examine the rogue track record of the Palestinians, by the way, among Arabs. They terrorized Egypt, they terrorized Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, Kuwait, and that's the reason that Arabs do not act. They only talk in favor of Palestinians, but they don't act in favor of Palestinians. And I think the challenge will be for President Herzog to present to the joint session, but also to the administration, that a Palestinian state west of the Jordan River would doom the pro-U.S. Hashemite regime east of the river, which would transform Jordan into an uncontrollable platform haven for anti-U.S. Islamic terrorists, creating ripple effects which could topple every single Arab oil-producing pro-American Arab regime in the Arabian Peninsula. Hopefully, the president will follow that line rather than engage in inter-Israeli political voyage.
Amen to that, sir. I think and we don't have time to get into this at all, but one thing that is a bit concerning is it seems as though he'd been playing a bit of a double game on this whole judicial reform business with, I suspect, back-channeling the United States, which is interested in subverting Prime Minister Netanyahu on that subject, among many, many others. Mr. Ambassador, we have to leave it at that for the moment. This is a very, very helpful overview, and we'll be watching closely what President Herzog says and does here in the United States, and we'll be, I'm sure, taking stock of it with you. God bless you, my friend. Come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.